Dave Graney has been making music since the late 1970s. He was even briefly, but gloriously, the king of pop. Well, that's how Dave termed it when he won an ARIA Award for Best Male Artist in 1996. But Dave has never really thought of these many decades in music as work. In fact, he's done his best to avoid anything that felt like it might belong in that category. Dave has instead spent his life embracing the noble Australian tradition of the bludge. And his new book is called Workshy, My Life as a Bludge. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
Bludge is such a great word. what does it call to mind for you?
Yeah, in a way, it's a bit of a teasing reference to the former minister for Centrelink, who had a name that rhymed with bludge. So it was a bit of a poke at him, I guess.
Well, Dol Bludges, that was a compound noun. You don't hear it as much anymore.
I think, I don't know whether it came from the Thatcherite kind of, a lot of the Murdoch press invented a lot of these things, like job snobs and the Thatcherite crew in Britain, and they had this really dark fellow called Norman Tebbit, who would just go on about job snobs and everything. He was a grim Dickensian character, like a lot of them. And Malcolm Fraser saw his role post Whitlam as, in his way, he expressed it as he saw Whitlam as a great transgressor for enlarging people's ideas of the possibilities of their lives. And Malcolm Fraser saw that as a demonic perversion of the natural order of things. And he wanted to, like many people from Australian history who are on the side of the constrainers, he wanted to bring that back to reset it back to reality. So Dol Bludges and words like that came in, and we live in a world where people on welfare and Centrelink, accessing Centrelink, which is a full-time job for people who have to do it, are demonised as losers, and somehow their lives are in a cul-de-sac of their own devising. But yeah, I never felt like a loser.
Which is, and it's kind of great then, I think, that you're using that term, because it doesn't have any kind of romantic connotations, bludge. I mean, even just the sound of the word, it's sort of, it doesn't strike one as a dandified sort of term. So I'm glad you're bringing it back as a code of honour.
Well, I have a friend who has a job in Melbourne to walk around. Is probably, I don't want him to lose his job, but he walks around the streets and he noticed, his job is to notice cracks in the pavement or obscured signs and to note that down and report it to somebody.
Wow.
And he has no sort of key points he has to achieve. And he just walks around, drives around,
noticing cracks and obscured signs.
Well, of course, that's what he's supposed to be doing, but his attention might wander. And when he told me about it, I said, well, that is a sweet job. I wish I had a job like that. And I'm often, being jealous of people who have jobs that, take up nothing in their mind, and jobs that are, I don't know, demand nothing of them personally.
Bring in a paycheck. There is some esoteric beauty in noticing cracks on a pavement. Whereabouts did you grow up, Dave? Where were you first introduced to the ideas of work and all its manifestations?
I grew up in Mount Gambier, South Australia, which is 300 miles from Adelaide one way, 300 miles to Melbourne the other. It had possessed of much natural beauty. Built on the edges of beautiful crater lakes in an extinct volcano, but surrounded by regimented, gloomy forests of imported California pine trees. That is the main industry of the area. It's blessed with amazing, abundant underground water, which the farmers have been very profligate over the years. And it's a strange area. People who came from it of much note are Sir Robert Helpman, who has a beautiful library in Mount Gambier, which has a holographic kind of image of Sir Robert Helpman now in the middle of the town, like a square mecca type building. And many of the locals are up in arms against it because they've never heard of him, or what's he doing there? But another character who came from there was Max Harris, who was involved in the
Angry Penguins.
The Angry Penguins, the modernist kind of art movement, and the Ern Malley affair. And he read every book in the Mount Gambier Institute Library, which used to be there when I was a kid, and won himself a scholarship to a private school in Adelaide. Became a conservative kind of voice, but it's a beautiful, beautiful place. Has some problems, like many country towns, but a unique kind of place. And Max Harris wrote about it quite beautifully in poems. He wrote about one about a nearby town called the Tantanoola Tiger, which is a town which had a legend of a tiger that escaped in it. And he wrote a beautiful poem about it.
Tell me about the house that you grew up in. What did it look like?
A lot of the houses in Mount Gambier are made out of limestone, and also the area I grew up in was Housing Trust, South Australian Housing Trust. It used to be an idea of government to, I think it was post-Second World War, to have housing, you know, to provide housing. And then lots of houses in the street were for school teachers. You could notice them by the particular iron fences they had. It was all made out of limestone, which is the stone of the area. And over the years, it would go kind of grey, and all people would paint it in thick, kind of viscous paint in it. So they looked like almost like cakes sometimes, like iced cakes. But it was people would have jobs sawing the limestone out of the quarries, and you can see these brawny fellows heaving big bricks of limestone on their shoulders. And one of them was my football coach when I was a little boy. Yeah, so the houses were like that. And the house I was in, my father Noel and my mother Philomena had six kids, and usually only four kids lived at home.
There was only room
at first,
for
yeah, and then two more came. Yeah, there was only three bedrooms, and no telephone, no car, and it was pretty, very optimistic kind of 60s, 70s upbringing, yeah.
What did your mum and dad do for a living?
My dad painted the country town, or the public buildings, the school, the jail. He was kind of fellow, very sociable fellow. He worked at nights at the Mount Gambier Hotel. That was mainly as much a social life, and I mean social, I mean getting away from the family, probably, I don't know. But he enjoyed the sporting life, and sport was a big thing in our family and in the town. And my mother had come to Mount Gambier from Narracourt as a seamstress, and thinking back how women moved around the world in the 1940s, they would have had to have some trade or something, some reason for drifting around by themselves. But I think she came to Mount Gambier from Narracourt with her sister Margaret, and she got a job as a seamstress, yeah, and she had a great talent for... occasionally she would take jobs mending clothes or for a local clothes shop, to resize them for people. And in Melbourne at the moment, there's Australian Music Vault, and they have clothes from, performers and musicians. And there's a suit that my mother made for me in 1985. It's a red velvet suit that she made. I was living in London, and she made it for me. It's quite sweet to see it there.
Your dad's worked as a painter and in the pub. Do you remember visiting him at either of those places?
I would have to go. He'd have Christmas parties at his work, which would be hilarious because Santa would always be so drunk in the daytime. and lots of kids running around, the place of work. And there was I would have to go and get my pocket money from him on Saturday mornings and go to the back of the hotel. It was quite a, walk down the street in my best clothes to get, 50 cents or something, and I'd go to the pictures. But it was a moment to see him in his kind of milieu of, beer-drinking mates. And it was all men with enormous beer guts, like shirt-busting beer guts. It was like erotic promenade of bellies. and including my dad at that stage. And yeah, it was a mysterious world. Even as a little kid, I thought, wow, how is that physically possible? How does that happen? But anyway, he would always introduce me to his mates, all men in the bar. He goes, hey, this is my number four son. He referred to me as number four son. And for that period of my life, I was always referred to as young granny.
Did you like that, or did that used to bug you?
I was a kid who just accepted, and I've always been a person, I don't question the world that much. If that's the way things were, and I was young granny. I had two older brothers, Philip and Stephen, who were gifted sports people, and my older sister, Marianne, I'm very close to my family, and there was no kind of role for female sports people so much. So as in John Howard's famous phrase, I guess women made their own arrangements. And anyway, my brothers, Philip and Stephen, were gifted footballers, and I kind of followed in their slipstream, but I was young granny, just drifting about out on the wing, doing my thing, and that's where I was, young granny.
So your dad, as a painter, did that mean he was a handyman, DIY kind of dad?
He left his tools at work. We had a hilarious relationship with tools. There were none, or they were broken.
Did he have a shed?
He had a shed. It was more like a kind of architectural lean-to, a humpy or something like that. It was, I don't know, it was a miserable arrangement of some corrugated iron and some bits of wood that just slumped over on itself. And you could crawl in there if you're a little kid, but it was just a place where cats went to die and or old bits of carpet or things. It was just quite kind of sad and taunted us.
What kind of attitude to paid work do you think you were raised with, Dave?
I don't know. Well, my dad was really sociable character, and he loved it when these rough kids from up the road would knock at our door with rabbits, he just loved it, and we hated
rabbits that they'd killed.
Rabbits, yeah, they'd go out and kill them or catch them, and he loved skinning them and cooking them. That kind of brutal cookery was the type he liked. And
Do you think he hoped for you a future as a rabbiteer?
I don't know. There were ideas about work. Yeah, I had an uncle who was a truck driver. I had another uncle who tried to be a priest, but he ended up in quite, white collar work, which was very odd for my family. It was all blue collar world, and they encouraged me to. They arranged a job for me in a service station at some stage, and I was very bad at it because I had cars were like not things I understood, how they worked or anything. But I liked them. I liked riding around in them, but I didn't know how they worked. So
you started off at Catholic primary school, but then went to state high school.
Yes, it was great.
Yeah, what sort of change in your identity did changing school systems?
It was like, when I grew up, I watched a lot of TV, and TV was a dumping ground for old movies, and I was educated by TV so much. It was British and American films, and some of my favourite actors from that period are from old BBC, not BBC, British movies. Long forgotten actors like Cecil Parker and David Tomlinson and Lance Percival, comic English actors, James Robertson Justice and Hattie Jakes, all that crowd. I really loved them. But it was like moving from a black and white world into full colour at the same time as puberty and everything. And
going to state school.
Yes, going to a Morris Brothers school was just like a cross between a boys' version of St. Trinian's, like a comic horror with just severe beatings constantly from brutish, kind of frustrated, men in their prime beating up on little kids. And, it was funny because the kids always won. The kids were hilariously inventive at annoying and taunting these men to angry bursts, but it was such a brutal world. And and quite bad as education, because they had no standards of education. They only had standards of Catholicism and beating, really. So thankfully, my mother took me away from there, because they'd both been to Catholic schools, so they often, if you told them, hey, I'm getting beaten up too much, and, you know, they'd had the same experience, so it was, you know, get used to it, you know, that's what life is. But after a while, when I wasn't learning anything, my mother took me to a Catholic school, to a state school, and it was fantastic. It was a great era of well-funded public schools, state schools, and girls, you know, being around girls at school. It was, you know, that girls were so smart. They were, you know, just naturally smarter than boys. And but it was. I loved it.
What was the sort of 15, 16-year-old Dave Graney wearing around Mount Gambier?
Was I wearing? I don't know.
Was your mum making outfits for you?
Oh, yeah, my mother. I was always wearing hand-me-down clothes, you know, from my older brothers and that. But luckily, you know, that was kind of the greatest fashion you could have in the early 70s was well-worn jeans. It wasn't new jeans. New jeans looked horrible. And so I had jeans with patches on them.
What sort of patches?
Well, I had patches just all over the knees and the backside. And in high school, my mother made a patch for the backside of my jeans with Dave embroidered across. I never had to look at it, but, you know, everybody knew who my name was.
It's Dave walking away.
I was no longer young Graney. I was Dave. So that was quite cool in a way. And I guess, you know, yeah, I just wore clothes like that, but it was the 70s, and so nobody really wore flares. You know, in American, you know, sitcoms set in the 70s, everybody dresses like that, but we wore straight-legged jeans. And
if you're lucky, you had your name on the bum.
If you were very lucky, you had your name on
it,
yeah.
What were you doing outside of school? How are you spending Friday nights, Saturday nights?
Right, I was involved in football all the way through my family was very tight, and I had lots of, you know, aunties and cousins all of the same age, and it was like comparative versions of our family. And you'd look across at what they were like, and they were, in a way, they were rivals in your mind. And one particular family in Mount Gambier was like identical brothers to ours, and we would always be like beating them at stuff. And another family in Narracourt was so great at violence, you know, when we'd have fights, they were so brutal. It was incredible. But so I broke out from my family, and then the Catholic Church. It's sort of the world widens, and the opportunities of life that you can perceive if you're, I don't know, attuned to things. And then the football club was very big for me because it was beyond the Catholic world. And my father was the number one life member of the club, you know, which was impressive to me because it was a name was nowhere in the world. You know, I'd look at maps of, is there anything named after our family? Is there a river, a lake?
The Grain Channel.
Yeah, there was nothing except my father was number one life member of East Gambier.
I want to play a song that I think you wrote post this period, but maybe about it. It's called You Had to Be Drunk.
To be drunk, to put it all together in any kind of way. I don't know how you could have walked that world otherwise. You had to be drunk to take the blows and take some pills to take the edge off playing the guitar. I took some weed. I could see the holes yawning between the beats. I was flying high above the land.
Dave Graney, you had to be drunk from We Was Curious in 2008. How accurate a depiction is that of life for you as a teenager in Mount Gambier?
That might answer your last question probably a bit better than I did. It was a world of alcohol, cars, you know, driving around when you get your license when you're 16 in South Australia and going to the drive-in. And it was me and my peculiar mates were teenagers, but, you know, normal kind of gruesome kind of humoured teenagers, and we saw the world as completely phony, and that's what the song's talking about, that piercing kind of conviction of teenagers that the world is a void, it's phony, I see it, no one else can see it, and let's get drunk kind of feeling, and so I wanted to write about that. I love that recording. It's got our bass player, Stu Thomas. He has this lazy behind-the-beat feel, and Claire Moore riding the cymbals, you know, drifting the power of the band. And we have a jazz pianist on that recording, Mark Fitzgibbon. He was so wonderful to play with, and our guitarist, Stuart Pereira.
Besides the job that your parents got you in the petrol station, what other jobs did you have as a teenager?
There was a period... I worked in a hardware store kind of, and I was hopeless at that too. And but I enjoyed drifting in between the back and the front of the house of the shop, the large shop.
Backstage and on stage.
Yeah, I thought that was quite exciting. And I enjoyed working when I did that, and as soon as I left school, I fronted up at the dole office on my way home from last day of high school.
The same day?
Yeah, I needed some bread to party.
And the guy
behind the counter I'd been to school with, and he was saying, "You can't sign on to this." I said, "Hey, I was working at the hardware store. They sacked me." And he said, "Okay, you can have it."
So you'd proved you'd tried employment.
I had all the, it was like a jailhouse lawyer's argument, you know. I partied severely. Had a really great time after I left school. And then I got a job in a timber mill.
Oh, how hard was that?
Oh, Sarah, it was so hard. It cured me of work for many years.
Physically hard? Like what?
It was there were lots of timber mills in Mount Gambier, so I just got a job. It was quite eye-opening. It was 1977, and I was at the end of a conveyor belt. There's a man next to me who could not speak much English. Another fellow worked next to me, and we would have to catch big planks of wood as they sped towards us, put them in groups of five, and swing them behind us to this busty kind of a blonde woman who always had a fag in her mouth, who was kind of like a flirtatious kind of sitcom character. And that was, you do that for 8 hours a day, yeah.
This is Conversations with Sarah Konoski on ABC Radio. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
Dave, you left Mount Gambier and moved to Adelaide. Tell me about your arrival in Adelaide. How did Dave Graney make his appearance?
Well, I was going to Adelaide because a lot of my pals had started university there, and they had a share house where they just partied on, and I just wanted to be a part of it. And I'd driven mostly around the east coast of Australia the year before in an old FC Holden. And then I got rid of my car because I'd been in it so long that I could only drive at 70 kilometres an hour, and it had no back to the front seat. It was exhausting to drive. So I had a Honda step-through scooter. I put it on the Bluebird train, which went between Mount Gambier and Adelaide, which was only one caboose. And one end was smoking, the other end was no smoking. And a woman with a fag in her mouth would bring down the trolley with sandwiches and teas. And I sat on it. It was a bit like a kitchen sink realist movie. I sat on it, and a a girl got on who was a bit sweet with a few years before, and we sat, you know, across from each other, kind of trying to fool each other that we had plans for our lives, and then fell silent and looked out the window. And that train would take about 8 hours to get from Mount Gambier to the foothills of Adelaide, then another 2 hours to get through the hills, stopping at all these little places. And then it stopped right in the centre of Adelaide, and I got my step through out, and I rode down the concourse out into the sunlight outside of the main intersection of Adelaide. And it was like the beginning of a TV sitcom, like, you know.
A glorious
new
era.
You're going to make it after all.
And you drove straight into your new life.
I did, yes.
And were you making music straight away as well as hanging out in this share house?
Just lived in a share house down in Glenelg, drinking flagons of wine, because Adelaide was a very, centre for wine production, I guess.
Was this civilised wine drinking?
Yeah,
was it
flagons? I had no sophisticated tastes to the extent that I would mix lemonade with my wine as I drank it to make it a bit more palatable. Because in my brutish teenage instincts, to get wasted was the only thing you drank for, because it had all alcohol still had a horrible taste. Really? So anyway, I just sat around and I bought a Gibson SG copy and I just sat around trying to learn the guitar for a couple of years. Yeah.
And were you playing in front of people? Did you have gigs?
Eventually we got a band together, myself and my friend Steve Miller from high school in Mount Gambier. We were very lucky to run into Claire Moore, who could play the drums, and she was a very sophisticated musician. And she had a couple of pals, Phil Costello and Liz Dearly on bass, and we formed a really horrible band, and we were so horrible we could hardly get any gigs, and we got a gig at one place in Adelaide. We talked them into letting us play. It was just really, it was really quite horrible. But
horrible for the audience, horrible for everyone.
It was probably had some elements that were quite good, but I found music very frustrating for many years because the people I liked. You know, it's like trying to be a writer and loving
Tolstoy.
You know, yeah.
Yeah.
You want to be like Tolstoy straight away. But it's not gonna happen for a few years. So so I found it very frustrating.
What did you want to sound like? What in your head was the perfect Dave Graney sound?
Well, our band was called the Sputniks. It was terrible. It was the name of it even I don't like, and somebody else in the band thought it up, and Steve Miller thought it was funny because Little Richard threw his rings off of Sydney Harbour Bridge when he saw the Sputnik going overhead in 1959 or something. And anyway, that still didn't make it cool for me. And just sounded awful. We did lots of cover versions of, almost did all of Johnny Thunder's Heartbreakers, Lamp album, New York Dolls, and Wire. And I really liked the Buzzcocks, and my voice was very much like Pete Shelley from the Buzzcocks, yeah.
You moved to Melbourne mm-hmm. with Claire and mm-hmm.
and Steve, and
the doll is still paying your way at this crucial genesis in the Dave
Being on
Graney
the doll
band.
Then was so good. You could post it in. You never had to go and visit them. You'd send it off in the post. So I posted it in Adelaide. They said, I'm moving to Melbourne. Can you send the check?
You're kidding me.
To this place. And being great public servants, it went so smoothly. It was great.
This is another world.
It was excellent.
But this, after a couple of years on the doll, you actually decided that you would join the world.
I don't know what got into me. Yeah.
What got into you?
I don't know. Steve Miller was a good, and Claire were very good, probably, role models, because they would always go out and get jobs, and I could see they had folding money and they had more choices in their lives and they were having more fun in a way. So I went for an interview for a public service job, and they used to have them in Melbourne, and there'd be like 400 young people in a room taking an exam, and then you would actually get a job. So I got a job, yeah.
And so this was your first time working in an office.
Yes,
what was the environment like?
Well, I had to go into the centre of Melbourne. I quite liked it, so commuting and doing that, working in the office and, you know, drifting around the city at lunchtime. It was very enjoyable.
An open plan setup?
It's quite open plan and, you know, desks, you know, people smoking at their desks, a tea lady coming around with giant buns and everything and flexi time and all that kind of stuff. It was great. And
what kind of figure did you cut? Like, did you mingle with your colleagues?
I was awkward and standoffish and creepy and I was, because my identity, I was in a band. I guess basically we wanted to go to the UK and I needed to get some money for airfare. So I just wanted to create a small footprint to drift through it like a phantom and don't bother me. I don't want to be part of, you know, group, you know, talking about other people or anything. Leave me alone.
It's just that weird guy, Dave, near the photocopier again.
I just want to be the weird guy. And you didn't like being the weird guy, but, you know, hell, if that's what I have to be, I'll be it. And then also, because I was so standoffish and non-participatory, I would do my work really quickly, which made me even creepier and, you know, didn't curry me any favours with the others in that way. It was nice. They were always very nice people, you know, trying to be friendly to me, and I would just have a force field around me that, you know, get your presents if they found out your birthday somehow. I don't want your stinking present. But, you know, funny people, you know, a guy who was kind of a hippie-ish type who would, every payday, which you get in cash in an envelope with your union deductions and everything and your flexi time and, you know, itemized. And he would go out and buy a bottle of Johnny Walker and a copy of Penthouse or Playboy and sit down with a smoke and peruse it at lunchtime.
In the office?
Of course, yeah. And so I don't know whether that's a tougher world or more.
You're painting an amazing picture of the Australian workplace, Dave Graney. I had no idea.
Yes, and but the job was quite upsetting. It was for Defence Service Homes, which was after people had served in the First and Second World War, people were given loans at very low rates to buy houses. And so there was no real computers. It was all folders and telephones. And you get these folders and it would be like a couple of generations of contact with people who'd had trouble in their lives and like alcoholism and stuff from the First World War and the Second and Vietnam. And it's all written down by generations of clerks. And it was very, you know, upsetting in many ways. And people were owing money and, you know, you're trying to ask them to please, you know, work out a plan to pay it. And otherwise there was a retired cop who would go around at the end and knock on their door. And still it was nothing like today. It was nothing like, you know, get out, you know, you're ripping off the Australian taxpayer. It was very gentle and the payments were small. But reading generations of phone calls noted down, I called up the applicant, distressed, drunk, you know, talking about violence and stuff. And others, Agent Orange, you know, from Vietnam, was still being argued about in the courts whether it was real or not. And so, you know, I'd drop a few folders down the lift well, or maybe Claire did that too. You'd lose a few things at the bottom of piles and say, you know, this person doesn't need any more harassment. So, but they also took us out to a hospital to show us people who were from the First World War, who had been in there since the 1920s with health problems. And they were still alive in, say, 1980. And, yeah, so it was quite confronting. And that's how...
That's one of the things work does.
Yeah.
Is it forces you to be in the world in a different way, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was. And the public service, seeing what the public service was in all those areas, how it was dealing with people and from real situations it was nothing in it about punishing people or disciplining them. It was kind of there for people. So it was good that I saw that.
You did manage to save enough money to get over to the UK.
Yes, I did, yeah.
Were you ambitious for music, to make a career there?
It was, music's quite funny. Often you're living out fantasies, and other times you're just expecting things to happen because, you know, you've seen the same things happen to other people. But often you have to show up and make things happen. And our band, the Moodists, were in their way quite a, what's the word, not proactive. We were quite...
Passive,
yes. And we followed in the footsteps of friends and peers, the Birthday Party especially, who'd come after the Saints. And the Go-Betweens, when we went to the UK, Claire and I moved into a squat in Hampstead that Robert Forster and Lindy Morrison had just thrown us the keys of and said, you know, they were going back to Sydney. And so we were kind of walking in other people's recent footsteps and expecting similar kind of things to happen to us, but it didn't. We failed to really make an imprint that was, you know, unique and individual in a way.
Do you think that was because of the way you guys approached it, or was it just the luck of the game?
It was a bit of both. We were a ferocious kind of group. We had no kind of guiding hand, which a lot of young bands really need someone. And the Go-Betweens, I think, and the Triffids had some you know, outside people who could guide them or suggest different ways to do things, or suggest don't do this or don't. The Moodists didn't have anything. We were like very raw. In some ways, when you listen to our music from that period, it's very authentic, untouched by any of the novelty production things of the period, which some of the Go-Betweens and Triffids records suffer from. You know, I'm just mentioning them because they're contemporaries and peers. You know, they had a lot of 80s production, which...
A lot of synth.
Yeah, ruined them as kind of unique units that they were, in my humble opinion. But our records, you know, sound very fresh and raw, and that's what we were actually like.
And so were you having to take paid gigs? Because I'm assuming the Dole wasn't paid to you in London.
No.
Okay,
no.
That's something. No. I'm not as envious as I was. So yeah. What were you doing for paid work in London?
We went out and sort of played, you know, went to Europe and played, and we didn't think about it much. I really don't know how we got by, really.
You did some work in a with a temp agency, like many a great Australian. Tell me about the Japanese bank, Nomura.
I kind of didn't work until, you know, we made our way somehow just playing music for a couple of years. And then after the Moodists kind of finished up, Claire started to go out and get some temp work, and then I kind of followed. And I quite enjoyed it. Like, living in London, you do need financial kind of power and energy to live there. And in Nomura Bank, I showed up, and it was like right in the city of London, which was a very exotic place to be, like the Mile Square, that is where the financial centre, and it was like a village. You could walk around the tiny streets anyway, And I showed up at this Japanese trading bank. It was the 80s, full of guys in suspenders and striped shirts.
Lots of
and
money.
Ponytails and that. And I was to work in the library, and I went in there as this young mod guy with his feet up on the desk, and I said, he's on the phone, and when he got off, I said, what do I have to do? He goes, well, when you get in magazines or something, you file them in the areas where, so it's a library. And I picked up a magazine and said, where do I put this? And he still had his feet on the desk, and he just grabbed it and chucked it across the room into the bin. He said, how would I effing know? It's in effing Japanese, isn't it? So when he left, I just put my feet up on the desk and got the phone, and I just started calling all my mates for however long I was there. So that was a sweet job for a while.
So did you learn, did the English have things to teach you about the art of the bludge, Dave?
Well, of course, they're very good at it, yeah. And but it was the height of the Thatcher era, when the miners' strike was on, and the English are just hilarious in there. Kind of, you know, you go, you get off your bus and go to a fruit stall and say, "Yeah, can I have one of those?" And they'd give you a bag from underneath of all the most rotten stuff, because you wouldn't sell someone good fruit, would you? They're weird in that kind of way. For a nation of shopkeepers, they just can't help ripping you off in that way. I enjoyed living in London immensely. It was like being in a dark, infernal furnace. It chewed people up at an incredible rate, and I read so many books, and, you know, I was able to break loose from a lot of my personal history and, I don't know, become more myself there, and I enjoyed it a lot. I don't know what I learnt from the English, really. They are endlessly great at hyping themselves in the music scene, actually. But
we're going to play the most recent single that you and Claire have put out. Can you just introduce it for us?
It's called Song of Life. I wrote this when I had an appendix operation last year, and there was terrible complications, of course, and I thought, oh, young granny's going to cop it here. So I wanted to write a song about my whole life in one tune, just in case it was the last one.
Staring out from my cot, back where I started, where it begins, where it stops. Meet everybody by the age of 10. You search for those cats again. Your life, faces in the street, you put them to that lens, try everything on, and your genes, oh, and so much is down to your genes, never knew such plenty, in your twenties, get real sentimental. In your thirties, get off of me. In your forties, get even better. In your fifties, then you better find something else to do.
It's the latest song from Dave Graney. It's called Song of Life, about successfully surviving an appendix operation. We're very grateful, Dave. We began talking about Mount Gambier and your life there, your family there. What's happened to the house that you grew up in?
Our house is on Warona Street, and it was near a street called Bowendick. And it had all these Aboriginal, Indigenous names about the area. And I found out that Bowendick is the name of the tribe who were in the area. My parents, Noel and Philomena, died in 2009. And the house was sold to a young family, I think, who were kind of scaring all the ghosts out of there at the moment.
Did you have to go and do that thing where you clear up and clear out a whole family's lifetime in a home?
Yes, me and my brother Philip had to do it. It was very, it was like very emotional. Of course, everybody goes through that kind of thing, and you have a big skip out the back, and what were treasured possessions suddenly just become junk or whatever. So we went through that whole thing and had a kitchen table. I took a photo of it. Me and my brothers are sitting at it. Comically, we just put it outside on the front lawn, and we're sitting at it, and at the scene of so much drama and comedy. It's funny to see it isolated, you know, and exploded and thrown out of the house like that. in a kitchen table with a formica top and that kind of. You see it in many op shop pubs nowadays.
I think early on in your music career, someone said to you, there's no retiring in this business. Is that how you see it?
Yes. As Billy Miller said that to me. He said, there's no retiring. It's both a threat and a promise. Because once you get used to that idea, you just settle down and enjoy all the indignity that it will certainly bring to you.
Indignity and glory, mm-hmm. I think, Dave Graney.
Mostly
surely.
Indignity. So get used to it.
It has been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Sarah. I've very enjoyed it myself. Thank you.
This is Conversations with Sarah Konoski on ABC Radio.
My guest today was Dave Graney, and his new book is called Work Shy. You can find the details of Dave's upcoming gigs on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Sarah Konoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Konoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.